Hi, and welcome to another episode of Puzzle Piece, the podcast dedicated to giving you tips and tricks about making it in the music industry. Today we're speaking to the amazing Eddie Perfect, a Tony-nominated performer whose amazing musicals have delighted fans across the world.
So for you, kind of entering the industry, wanting to create musicals and go down that path, looking back, how do you feel like that started for you? What was your example of getting your foot in the door?
I had kind of a long period of, so this is how I've come to define it now that I'm 43 now. So I'm not old, but I'm not young anymore. And I think about, you know, my 20s being really important to me in terms of establishing my career. I'm going to be honest, I think your 20s are important for anyone establishing a career. Yes, you can do it later and you can change. But, I think creatively speaking, in your 20s, you have the most sort of flexibility to move, to follow opportunities, to not be responsible for, like little kids and stuff, and be able to go out and see as much stuff and tour and travel and commit yourself to a life that becomes a little less free, if that's for want of a better word, as you get older, when you start to accumulate more responsibilities. So I call it my shit kicking 20s, where, I did a lot of stuff that just kind of sucked in the end and wasn't very well paid, and it was pretty stressful, and it was out of my comfort zone, or it wasn't successful, or I didn't really know what the point of it was. And so you have this weird thing in your 20s that, yes, you're incredibly, available to do lots of different things, but also in your 20s, you still don't really know what you don't know yet. So, and if you're ambitious like I was, you find yourself in this place where you can see yourself as like, I have all of these skills and all this talent, and I look over there to that pasture where people are performing in the way that I want to be performing and getting the opportunities that I want to get, and I look at them and I think, I've got as much talent as them. Why am I here and they're over there, and how do I get over there? And so everything between here and there is really fucking frustrating, because you're like, this is unfair, it's too hard, why aren't I getting enough opportunities? But while that's happening, the thing that you don't know is that you need to, you are not as good as you think you are. You're nowhere near as good as, I was nowhere near as good as I thought I was, because, in my head, I'm like, I'm counting my potential as money in the bank. I'm counting what I think I know I'll be able to do as like something that I've already done, which I haven't. And I also haven't failed enough, and I haven't tested my ideas in the real world. So I'm looking at people's actual, literal, real work, and I'm comparing it to make-believe, theoretical, potential work that doesn't exist yet in my head. Now, of course, in my head, the work's amazing and much better than this person's work, which really exists, which really had to go through an actual process to arrive at what it is. So it's a completely unfair comparison, A, because I haven't made it yet, and B, because I haven't had to make it in the real world either, where it's subject to lots of different forces that are going to shape and change it. One of them could be, wow, I can't actually sing this thing, or I can't actually perform this thing that I wrote for myself, or it's too long, or it's actually got boring bits in it, or it doesn't make as much sense now that it's out of my head and on the page. It doesn't make as much sense. So that's the thing with being 20 in your 20s, is that, your ambition can kind of overrun where you are in your career. And so when I talk to a lot of young people about it, I'm like, yeah, you're really talented. But you're just going to have to kick the shit for 10 years, and it gets better. But, I did all sorts of weird things, but a diverse range of things that gave me a lot of experience. And one of the things I was very lucky to do was to be able to, I'm not a great piano player, and I'm a terrible sight reader. I can't sight read a poem enough, but I'm very musical, so I can learn something pretty quickly. But if you put like complicated sheet music in front of me, I'm going to botch it. But I did actually musically direct a few people's cabarets, and you know, obviously that's not a sight reading exercise necessarily, because you know, you're in a process and you're choosing material and you're also arranging material. You're like, you know, maybe we could take these three or four songs that are thematically linked and we can turn them into a kind of a medley, or we can move from one moment to another, or we can do this, or, and you have to transpose the keys of things, and you have to do things in different styles in different ways, because music is malleable and you're changing it around in order to tell the story for this cabaret artist. And on one hand, you can be like, why am I putting all this effort in and it's not my show? Well, the reason that's good is because, you know, you can learn from somebody else's successes and mistakes while protecting yourself. So, you know, unless you kind of completely botch the job, you know, you're like an active creative passenger on this creative journey, where whatever happens, it could be the best show ever. Great, you got to see what a successful process was. It was the worst show in the world. Okay, it wasn't very good, but you know, you get to learn why it wasn't very good, what went wrong. Probably learning what went wrong is more important than being in a successful show. And all the time you're somewhat sort of protected because it's not your show. So I was fortunate enough to do that quite a lot. And I wrote songs for other people, and I wrote them for free because I just wanted to have the opportunity to write for a different voice or a different idea. And because, and then slowly you know, you're starting to amass credits and you're amassing experiences and you're creating a reputation because you're working with other people, and people are like, oh, hey, if you're doing a show, I just worked with this guy, Eddie Perfect. He's like really creative. He's really easy to work with, lots of ideas. And then people are like, cool. And then you work with those people, and then someone's doing a theater show and they need a couple of songs, and they're like, oh, why don't we use Eddie? He's really fast and he's like got great ideas and he's funny. And people start to vibe on your vibe and your talent. But it's long, and it's not like a corporate job where you start then the, you know, as a junior, and then you have a kind of a clear hierarchy of working your way up the ranks. It's not linear, it's sort of just like circular, and then an opportunity comes, and then it doesn't really work out. It's very deflating, and you got to just kind of keep marching on. It's a long, difficult process, but I do believe, maybe because I'm an optimist, that you know, the cream always rises, and that when you do good work, the work travels way further than. I was never a great networker. I mean, I'm a friendly person and I don't mind chatting to people, but I never got a job in a foyer. Every job I got was because of what happened on stage. And I always believe that the work travels a lot further than, you know, a handshake or, a, you know, some kind of deal in a lobby. So I always tried to put as much effort into the work every single time. And you were just slowly cultivating a reputation. And it's difficult and it's hard for it. But your reputation is like so important, because if you fuck it up, it's as bad as it hangs around. Like the last thing you want is people to go, hey, why don't we use Eddie? And someone's like, I didn't have a great experience with Eddie on this. And normally people will go, okay, all right. I had a good experience on this, but you know, I hear you. Why don't we move on to another idea? That's how quickly it happens. I know, because I've been in those conversations. It's like, do we really want to, you know, do we want to find ourselves at 3 a.m. in tech when the chips are down with somebody we don't like, who has a reputation for not collaborating, or who has a reputation for, you know, being mean or being a bully or not getting their way or throwing tantrums or just being a bit of an asshole or a bit of a dick? You're like, why would I actively choose to have that in my life? And so those people very, very quickly get relegated to the sidelines. You don't want it to be you. So you have to work very hard not to make that happen, because sometimes it's this tiny job in like butt fuck nowhere where, you know, you think nobody's watching and you throw a tantrum and you yell at a sound person, or you're some kind of an asshole in some way and you think it doesn't matter because these people don't matter. Well, people remember, and it's very, very small industry. So that stuff gets around. And when you go to work at, like, try to work at Melbourne Theatre Company, someone might be like, actually, you know, I was on the tech crew and that person was a real asshole when they came to town. And so it's like, oh, well, I'm not going to work with them. So that's how quickly and easily it happens. So it's a very circuitous way to say that, how do you get your stuff out there? It's a real slog and it's hard. It's hard mentally. It's hard sort of physically. But you really need to do it with as much care and love for the people and for the work at every single step of the way, no matter how small it is. That's my answer.
And then for you, like, slugging away in these jobs that maybe looking back, you're saying that they maybe weren't the most enjoyable, and the cabaret shows and stuff like that. Do you feel like you could, that almost got you to a starting point where you could create, say, the a cappella album you did with Tripod or your Shame War musical? Like, without that sort of run up, you might have not got to that position. Or do you feel like you would have got there anyway without any of that backup?
Well, this is the thing. It's such a tangled web. It's hard to tell when you take one aspect out of it what would remain. It's so hypothetical. But, you know, I think about my abilities as a composer or as a musician or as somebody that uses music in a theatrical setting. Every single thing I've ever done in music and theatre, or every book that I've read or every article that I've read or every piece of theatre that I've seen, or every contemporary art exhibition I've gone to, it all goes in a pot. And when you're a composer, for example, or a lyricist, like, there's no limit to how big your pot can be. So I was really lucky that I had a very broad range of musical experiences growing up. I sang in a lot of choirs. I sang in contemporary a cappella choirs, but I also sang with a South African guy for a couple of years, singing, you know, traditional South African music. Plus, I sang in a classical choir with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, doing, you know, the great sort of choral concert works, like, you know, Karloff's Carmina Burana, or like Handel's Messiah, or St. Bach's St. Matthew's Passion, or Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. So these are big, huge choral masses that are, like, you know, with 120 singers. That's, you know, with fugues and, like, just crazy shit going on in the writing where, like, how do you get exposed to that? You get, you know, like, being a performer and being a singer has given me the front row seat to a lot of musical experiences that I wouldn't have gotten if I was a composer who didn't perform and relied on other people to perform my music. I think that's a big distinction that needs to be made, because some composers, you know, are like, oh, I don't really sing. So they write stuff and then they're reliant on having somebody else to sing it. And I guess that's kind of fine. But what you don't get then as a non-singer is participating in musical events that shape the way you compose. You know, you might get those as an instrumentalist, but, like, for me, you know, being able to, you know, perform Beethoven's Missa Solemnis with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra was, you know, an extraordinary eye-opening experience. Being able to be in, to perform in a production of Carousel with Opera Australia and Lincoln Center, you know, I have to say that I was not really that across Rodgers and Hammerstein. I mean, I was a little bit across Rodgers and Hammerstein, obviously, but when you're in a musical, you learn about how you make a musical, because you see the ingredients. You're like, wow, this is like South Pacific. You just accept that it's South Pacific, but South Pacific begins with a scene. It doesn't even begin with a song. It begins with a scene that has three different songs in it. And it's a strange beginning. It's like a prologue, I guess. And then you see these tiny little scenes and then and how one song leads to another. And you're like, this is actually really quite unusual. It's like being able to open up, you know, you know, open up the kind of session files for a Christopher Nolan film, like Inception, and to be able to see, oh, they actually, you know, when you watch the film, you take it as a whole and you experience it. And if you're like me, I don't try to kind of like analyze things frame by frame. I allow myself to be an audience member and I, you know, allow the filmmaker to take me from moment to moment and experience it in real time. And that's how I watch movies. You know, I'm not a filmmaker, so I don't kind of go, oh, hang on, he was doing, you know, I like to be in it. But if you see the edit of it, you could go, oh, wow, that's actually like a really, just that image exists like for less than a second and then it moves to that image. And the brain just creates a kind of a connection between those two things. And it's the same in musicals, how one moment can lead to a next. And when you're in it, you're like, wow, that's really interesting how that's been done. So I would say that all of the musical experiences I've had, like playing in bands, singing and guesting in other people's bands, playing keyboards in people's bands. You know, when I was studying at Whopper, I also played percussion and sang backup for a female singer-songwriter who put an ad up on a notice board in Whopper saying, you know, singer-songwriter looking for second musician. And I was like, oh, yeah, I still had my African djembe from playing with Balanga for 2 years. And I went along and we just jammed out in a couple of songs. And then I had this great experience of kind of plugging into the Perth live sort of folk music scene because I played with Tessa and we actually she recorded an album and I played and sang on that. We recorded that in Fremantle and, you know, all the while I'm studying musical theatre, but I'm having these great musical experiences and learning about how to be a muso, learning about how audiences operate, what people like, and those things go in if you're a composer. And you're like, oh, yeah, I've got this big palette of colours that I can paint with. You know, I know that I can write sort of Cuban Latin big band. I can write salsa. I can write tango. I can write traditional South African music. I can write high life. I can write Afrobeat. You know, like knowing all of this music, experiencing and playing all of this music is so vital because otherwise, you know, your bandwidth of the musical ideas you can draw on is very small. So being curious and being involved has been vitally important for me.
Yeah, and it seems like it's almost integral to create something good, to have that broad thing of different genres, different types of music, musicals, band music, rock music. And then for you, I know you've spoken about when you did Shane Warne, the musical, you said you created it in a vacuum, but do you feel like that because you had this rich experience of different bands and everything going into it, that you maybe didn't need to show it to any other people? Like it, there wasn't a need to, because you felt like, oh, I know what can go right with this. I know what can go wrong with this. Or did you feel like you maybe did need to show it to others looking back?
It's a really good question. I mean, I guess that ties into like, you know, how I look at Shane Warne the musical now. And if I could go back and alter some parts of the process, what would I do? The short answer is I probably wouldn't change anything because I learned a lot by having to do everything. And because at that stage I didn't have collaborators that I thought had the same sensibility as I did to tell the story with me. So if I'd brought in on the wrong, if I brought on the wrong person, I knew, instinctively knew it would be far more damaging than having no one, because I knew what I wanted to write and I couldn't find anyone that sort of was what would I have been looking for? An experienced music theatre book writer who could write comedy, who also saw what I saw in the Shane Warne story. and could work with me collaboratively to, you know, find a way to tell the story. So that's why, you know, the first incarnation of the show was sort of like, you know, 98% music. And it was also 98% music because it was directed by Neil Armfield, and he'd just done Keating, and Keating was incredibly successful and had no book at all. And I was not a confident or an experienced book writer. So he was like, let's just do music. Whereas the second time I did it, I was sort of felt like it needed more in terms of script, and I had more confidence. And also Simon Phillips, who directed it then, was much more open and kind of encouraging the idea of me writing script. Now, not that that made it any better necessarily or worse. It was just different. And then I saw an amateur production of it down in Tasmania, and I was like, wow, this musical is really long. Like, it's long. And it's like each song is a big set piece song. And so it's sort of similar. It's similar to Keating in that it's sort of like, you know, you tell the story almost like a kind of an acted out song cycle. But except with Warnie, there's a bigger ensemble. There are more characters and they kind of come in and out. And it's, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, it's sort of almost like sung through. And so, you know, I am grateful that I did all of that on my own. And I'd certainly had a lot of ideas, but I took a long time to write it. And what I know now about writing is that, you know, a big part of the pace at which you write is just making decisions, you know. Oh, should I do this or should I do that? And that's where I'm stuck now, is like I have all of this kind of lockdown time and you know, not a huge, no real pressure. There's no like actual deadline for this project I'm writing now. But that's difficult for me because, you know, a deadline makes you make a decision. A deadline is actually so fundamentally important to writing anything, I believe. This notion that, you know, deadlines somehow ruin art. I think not having a deadline, like time ruins art, too much time. Because, you know, you can overwork stuff, you can overthink stuff, you can, you know, time, the task expands to fill the time. And, yeah, so all I know is that it would have been great to have someone to bounce off to go, you know, how do I go here or do I do A or do I do B, you know? And working on Beetlejuice, for example, in New York, is just to put that as like a very different process where, you know, not only did I have one book writer, I had two. They wrote as a team, Scott and Anthony. Also, you know, the role of a director in Broadway is very kind of like, almost like a showrunner or, you know, a line producer. They start very early and they're there from the beginning of the project and they're guiding their creativity and them and their opinion on stuff is brought to bear in the project from the very beginning, from even before I began. So I come in and then I create stuff and there's constantly this feedback loop of like, oh yeah, I think we should try this or we could go here or that's interesting. But what about, you know, in the second verse we go, there's just someone guiding it the whole way. And not only does that shape the material in a certain direction, but it's a constant kind of like creative feedback loop that gives you something to write for and focuses your work and keeps, you know, the kind of cogs of creativity greased. And it just means you're faster. Like, oh, okay, cool. I'm getting feedback and you write to that feedback and, you know, in a trusting relationship like on Beetlejuice where, you know, every note you get is incredibly considered and respectful. And, you know, if you want to go, hey, I actually think this will work and I really want to try it, then everyone's like, cool. When you're in that experience, it's the best thing ever, you know. And when you don't trust your collaborators in that experience, you're just basically chasing people's shitty notes all around the field and then you're trying to please people. And then you get to the end of the process and you've like just been trying to please them. So you keep bringing back the worst version of your work. You know, you bring something that's interesting, you get notes, get changed to this, change to that, change. And then you kind of bring the next iteration of the work is shitter than the one that came before, and then you get more and it's just shit, and you're like, maybe they'll like this, maybe they'll like that, and you forget, what do I think is good? What do I want to put on stage? Do I even want to put this on stage? And you end up with this like fucking terrible shadow of the work you wanted to put on stage, and then you put it up and then it's shit, and then everyone's like, oh, that person wrote a piece of shit, and you're like, oh my god, I was trying to please somebody that I shouldn't have been trying to please. And that's a hard thing to learn, because you've got to know when to fight for your work and when to compromise. And that's an extraordinary, that's a whole other conversation when you do that. So yeah, that's difficult. But I am grateful for the Shane Warne experience, and I wouldn't change it, because every mistake I made was, you know, a very interesting learning curve, a learning kind of tool.
And you were mentioning Beetlejuice there, and then listening to that demo album you and Beetlejuice put out last year, and kind of hearing your process through some of the songs and stuff like that. And I feel like it relates to a lot of people even making their way in the music industry here, just playing folk music or something. The whole idea of co-writing and or having other people there with you, and maybe having to let go of songs that you really care about and that you put a lot of effort and time into. And just off the top of my head, a couple of songs off the demo album, like Gotta Get Out of This House and Ain't It Strange, for example, they're clearly songs that you cared a lot for and put a lot of time into, and are both amazing songs. But how do you kind of deal with having to drop them? I mean, how do you deal with having to, I guess, that whole idea of killing your babies?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, it's really hard to do it on your own. So if you're in a process where it's just you, and you have to make a decision about what to keep and what to cut, it's really hard, because you don't really know. It's like that expression, you know, when you're inside the circle, you can't see the circle. And so that's really tricky. And then when you work with other people, then, you know, suddenly you've got people telling you you should cut stuff. And that's its own issue as well. So, for example, with like Ain't It Strange from Beetlejuice, I remember we were talking about the ending and, you know, what should the ending be? And, you know, when Beetlejuice kind of crashes in and sort of saves everyone, should he have a song? Or you're working all this stuff out, because you don't really know what's going to be. You're like, maybe we'll just, you know, maybe Lydia has a song, or maybe we just need to get, which in the end we did, maybe we just need to get through to jump in the line because of the timing or whatever, you know. But you don't know when you're writing it. You got a vague idea when you're writing a show, but you don't really know where we at stage time wise. And so I got the idea for Ain't It Strange, because this, the idea that Beetlejuice was the villain for the whole show and then he suddenly becomes the hero, I just thought was really funny, because it would just piss everybody off that, you know, he gets to go, you know, this is a story about a hero called Beetlejuice who saved everyone, and that everyone would have to like begrudgingly go, oh, that's so annoying, but yeah, he did. And so that's where the idea for the song, you know, When an Arsehole Saves the Day comes from. And then everybody would have their moment to kind of, every character would have their moment to go, you know what, I was an arsehole. I did that. I did, you know, I lied or I cheated, or I was like so sort of self-obsessed or blind or whatever. I was an arsehole. Sort of like, everyone got to confess that they were an arsehole, and then they would all sort of like sing in a sort of hair, you know, let the sunshine weigh in. That, you know, that we're all arseholes. And so, so when I set that off, I remember Anthony King came back first. Anthony lives in Los Angeles, and Scott Brown lives in Massachusetts somewhere. So just because of the way time works in the world, I would, write during the day, and I would, here in Australia, and I would demo the song, and I'd sort of send it off when I was happy for it to go off at nighttime. And then I would wake up to notes. And it's kind of it's actually quite an efficient way to work because, you know, you're not writing songs, sending them off at night, waiting for people to wake up, spending the day listening to them. You know, you kind of get up the next day and have a whole bunch of notes and you're ready to write again. It's like having a 24-hour team. The only issue is that Anthony was kind of like slightly more critical than Scott, and he lived in Los Angeles, so he woke up first. And so he would often give feedback first, and then I found that, you know, on And It's Strange, he was like, I don't think we really want to say that our show is about everybody being an asshole. And I was like, okay. I was like, I think it's pretty funny. He was like, that is not what we're saying. That is not the point of the show, that everybody is an asshole. I was like, okay. And then, you know, everyone else chimes in. They're like, okay, maybe it could be rah, rah, rah. But he had a way of, Anthony had a way of kind of like framing the feedback. So I had to eventually like change the way I sent things so that everybody would get things all at once. So I'd sometimes just send things off early in the morning or really late at night when I knew everyone was awake. Because, you know, you do have to be a little bit strategic about how you, you know, the first person to give feedback does actually have a knock-on effect on how everybody else has their feedback. It's like, you know, if you make a movie and you put it out there and everyone just turns up on their own to watch it, they'll form their own opinion. But if you say, hey, read this review first and then go and see it, there's a lens now through which you're, oh, well, this person thought that. So it kind of colors the way you see it. So I had to be a little bit strategic about, you know, how feedback would happen. And you just have to look after your work a little bit in that respect. But God, it's good to have people that are like, you know, yeah. So, you know, I was like, okay, cool. And I was in a very people-pleasing frame. It was my first Broadway show. And I was like, I am going to be super positive and, you know, I'll write anything and I'll change anything and I'll do anything. And I was like, you know, had so many ideas, which is why there are so many cut songs, because I was just like firing on all cylinders with this. I was like, this is my opportunity. You know, I'm getting to climb the mountain. I'm going to write all these amazing songs. And if one idea is not working, I'm going to come up with another idea. And send so many ideas. People just like wake up and there's like a whole new song 24 hours later. What about this? And it just meant that, you know, I did get to a point where I was like, okay, you know, I'm not pulling these songs out of my asshole. Like they're taking an extreme amount of effort and work and I am going crazy on them. So, you know, be a little bit gentle with your feedback. But ultimately I was so focused on, you know, trying anything and taking a swing at stuff. Even if I hadn't asked for a song, I was like, maybe this idea. And ultimately it meant, you know, we had a lot of ideas to choose from and some stuff fell away. Some stuff fell away because the scene that it was written for got cut or, you know, whatever. So I learned about cutting in Beetlejuice, not just cutting whole songs, but when we came to do the show, Alex Timbers would be like, I think we need to lose that second verse. And I used to find that really confronting. And now I'm a lot better at it because I've experienced working with Alex Timbers on Beetlejuice. And what happens sometimes is you cut down a song and it's better than it was before, heaps better. And a lot of the time, the stuff you're cutting, if you want to really be honest with yourself as a writer, you know, the reason you need to cut it is because the audience already knows what's going on and they're ahead now and you don't want them to get ahead. But the reason you want to keep it is because there's something about it that makes you look really fucking clever. And you're like, this is, you know, this is such an amazing rhyme. This is such a brilliant joke. So then I got used to kind of going, well, if there's an A joke in a section of the verse that needs to be cut, why don't I take that joke out and put it into the first verse? Why don't I find a place for this? So you start to kind of like cherry pick great moments, cut, distill. So you've got, you know, you've got A jokes and get rid of all the B jokes. And because I'd written so much for Alex Timbers over the course of writing Beetlejuice, you know, he was also really good at going, you know, you've got some B jokes in this song. Like, and they're just because the A jokes are so strong, when we get to them, we're like, you know, he was the only person I've ever worked with that would just be like, I think that needs a joke. I think this lyric, I think you need to put a joke here. And, you know, I love writing like that, you know, because I write jokes all the way through my lyrics. And so Alex was the first person that sort of recognized it and wasn't like, you know, sometimes you can be with songs like a little bit sensitive and go, oh, you know, it's great, you know, it's really cool, but, you know, I really like it. But he was like, he treated my songs like a comedy script. He'd be like, this joke's not great. Can you swap it out for another joke? And there's always another joke. And so I'm like, you know, we've done heaps of stuff where I'm just rewriting lyric jokes over and over again, and I love it. So it's good.
Yeah, and was that also true of different, like, motifs on the musical side, different motifs and maybe like hooks and stuff like that you use from cut songs into songs that did end up going in, or just with the jokes?
Yeah, you know, sometimes you get a brilliant lyric that you'd be like, okay, if I can find another place for that, I will. And so they kind of persist in that way, or you're like, where am I going to stick that one? But then musically, I mean, I don't really have a kind of like a approach to kind of writing a score where I'm like, these are my melodic themes and then they're going to come out here and they're going to come out there. I kind of get a sense of what each character is going to sound like, and then I have a strong sense of what I think the whole night in the theater should sound like, you know, from a musical perspective. Like, is this going to be, you know, it's going to be a kind of a, you know, I really took my cue from, you know, the Harry Belafonte stuff, you know, that it was going to have a kind of a, you know, a jerky sort of like a dance hall sort of, you know, real groove based sort of stuff. So that was kind of a big part of how I thought about writing the score. And then, as you go on and you're adding songs to the pot and you're sort of starting to get an idea of what each character sounds like, then, you know, it's really easy to go, oh, well, it sounds like it should be a reprise of this moment here. Like, for example, I always really like the song Invisible that opens the show. It was just one minute song. And it was never really intended to be anything other than that, but I remember there was a point at which before Beetlejuice meets Lydia on the roof, we wanted a sad moment for Beetlejuice. And for some reason, it took so long to come up with this idea. And it seems so obvious now. But I was like, oh, he should sing a reprise of Invisible, because that's what he and Lydia share. They both feel invisible. And I was like, oh, okay. So I wrote, but that came quite late. And I actually think that writing musicals is kind of like being in a video game where everything that happens that you see on stage generally, if it works, is pretty obvious. Like, of course you would do a reprise of Invisible there. And so when you start off in a musical, writing a musical, you're like, okay, we can see all of the levels from here until opening night, and we just got to do that, we'll do that, and we think we're really intelligent, and that this idea will link to that idea and the story to blah, 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 blah. And then for some reason that doesn't work, and you go, okay, and you all together, you have to try and fix things and you move things around, then you all make a discovery together and you're like, oh, why didn't we see that at the start? You know, like why did that only come now? And I think of it like a video game where you have to complete the level together before the door appears and you're allowed to go to the next level. And it's like each thing unlocks as you go through. And there's nothing about the process that will allow you to skip those levels or just to be able to see. You can be the smartest person in the world, but there's shit that we did not see that was so obvious in Beetlejuice. Like sometimes until we were in tech, we're like, oh, that should be, why isn't that there? That should be that, you know. I wrote you know, Barbara 2.0 while we were in tech in for Broadway, you know. So we'd done the show out of, we'd done like a million workshops and labs. We'd done the show a whole season in Washington, D.C. You know, we're like, and it wasn't until, yeah, we were in the theater and I was like, oh, this fucking ballad that Kerry Butler's singing, and she's singing it beautifully, but it's not right. We changed it from DC because we didn't want the Maitlands to be banging on about their miscarriage, because, like, you know, that's something we learned. Miscarriages aren't funny. You know, but even at the time, we're like, oh, yeah, of course, they're a miscarriage. That's why they're sort of, that's what the sadness is about there. But, like, it's amazing how an audience in DC was just like, oh, that's just like way too sad, a fact. And that just was like a cloud that carried through the whole show. People are like, oh. So, like, okay, well, obviously that's got to go. So, you know, you wrote another ballad to replace that, and Kerry was singing that really well. It's just like, this just does not feel, it's just creating this energy hole. And then, so, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm going to start thinking about another song. But it's like so much of a process in order to get a new song in there, especially when no one's asked for it. But I had that kind of like, you know, kind of a, and the chord progression, I was like, oh, that's really nice. And then I thought, what am I going to do for the verse? And I just, for some reason, got to get out of this house. I was like, oh yeah, that has a similar tempo and energy. And it's like just sitting there doing it. I was like, well, nothing wrong with stealing from yourself if the song you're stealing from is a song that you wrote and it got cut. No one's going to hear it. I'll just take that bit. And it wasn't actually later in the Beetlejuice process that I started to kind of go back and strip mine the cut songs a little bit. Like, oh, what about that? Can I put that in there? Or I can't remember what that happened with. What else that happened with, but it did happen quite a bit. And then I also remember thinking, like, with the final song, Jump in the Line, visually you could see that Lydia was on stage and she had the whole everyone around her and she was sort of home, she's going to be okay, but nothing really said that. And because it's a, you know, it's not my song, Jump in the Line, Shakes in Aura, I was like, I can't change it. But I was like, hey, can I stick a bit of something in the middle of it? And Alex was like, oh, yeah, give it a go. And so I just kind of got this idea for putting, you know, a reprise of the chorus of Dead Mom into it. And, like, and the idea that occurred to me while I was doing that, which had never occurred to me in the whole fucking 4 years I've been writing the show, that was so obvious, but speaks to this point that you just, for some reason, you just need to kind of be inside the process before that idea will unlock, was the fact that the Banana Boat song says, daylight come and we want to go home. And then our entire theme for our show is home. Like, what is home? Where is home? What is home once the person that defines home is gone? And then how do you find home again? What is that? How do you define that? She sings a fucking song called Home in the, Lydia sings a song in the second act called Home. And I was like, holy shit, daylight come, we want to go home. Like, it's just sitting there like an absolute gift. It's been there. Been there. Like, this is the movie, you know, I feel like it's been there for decades and I didn't see it. Nobody saw it. And then we're all like, that's genius. It just makes it feel like it was written for our show. But that came at the 11th hour. That came like the day before we went into tech at the Winter Garden Theatre. So, you know, that's what's really interesting about it, is no matter how much experience, time or skill, you know, you do have to live inside something before things turn up. So when people are like, well, we can write a musical in a year. Yes, you can. Absolutely, you can. Sometimes I used to wish you could, because it's so long and protracted. But some things just take time to occur to you and they make the process and the piece richer and deeper and cleverer and more connected. And you need all the time for those things to arrive. You can't just go, oh, well, I'm going to skip levels 1 to 20 and do the final level 21 and defeat the boss. You know, you haven't got the potions to make the arrows. You haven't got the skills or the magic or the health or whatever. There's stuff that you learn along the way that earns your place to the end. And if you skip any of those steps, the piece suffers because of it.
Mm. So I've taken up way too much of your time. So just to kind of wrap up, if you could kind of go back and speak to the Eddie who's just making his way and wants to sort of establish a career in the industry, would you give him any advice? Would you tell him to do, keep something in mind, do anything differently?
Well, I have been thinking about this a bit because, you know, we're locked down. I'm not, you know, my life went from being very full, too full, like kind of stressful in New York, to being like kind of, you know, empty and domestic and, you know, every day is the same. Feed the kids breakfast, help the kids with online school, you know, walk the dog, cook dinner, watch television, you know, put the kids to bed, go to bed. And it's like, you know, I don't mind. I really love my family. I really love that side of my life, but I realize that it's always kind of gone in parallel with the much more exciting part of my life, which is, you know, having a job and working with other people and working in the theater and wrestling with ideas and, you know, and the constant kind of like pressure and anxiety and proving yourself that never really goes away. When I was in my 20s, I was, you know, I desperately wanted to know from my sort of mentors, do I have what it takes to make it? Am I going to make it? And my biggest fear throughout my entire career, and it's eased off a little bit, but it's still there because, you know, whatever my career looks like from the outside, and I don't really know because I'm on the inside of it, you know, I've got a lot of things that I want to do and I want to achieve. So even creating something that is like considered successful doesn't mean your life and your career ends. You know, it's because Hugh Jackman wins an Oscar or plays the role of his life, it doesn't mean he just like sits down on the couch with a cup of tea and is like, ah, oh, great, you know, tick. Now I can just relax for the rest of my life. Like, our life is designed to be lived. And, you know, our work is something that we love to do. It sustains us. And I think we kind of have to, even if there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, believe that the best stuff is ahead of us, that we've still got something to contribute. It's exciting. And at the moment, that's a very difficult thing to reconcile because, you know, my life, is my world is of friendship is smaller because I have a wife and I have a family and I have work and there's not a huge amount of time for outside stuff. But in my 20s, you know, I was like going to gigs, I was sitting in with other bands, I was watching people play, I was like, you know, seeing films and, you know, meeting people and chatting to people and performing, and there was a really vital conversation going on about, you know, my art form and how it responded to the world and how it worked in context with the other artists that were part of my community, whether that was like, you know, the musical theater community or what predominantly became the comedy community. You know, we were involved in each other's work and lives and seeing stuff and doing stuff and getting up and trying stuff and experimenting musically and jamming and, you know, drinking and taking drugs and seeing people play and seeing other people perform and going, whoa, I love that idea from that, like, you know, German rock show that I saw. I brought that into my work. I did, and you're like, you never want to go home and you always want to be the last person and there's always some new connection or discovery to be made, and it's exhausting and it's wonderful, but it's like it's very immediate. It's being an artist, and I don't have that immediacy anymore. I don't have that life anymore. And even if suddenly, you know, for some way without causing me any pain, my wife and my kids disappeared and I was totally unencumbered with any responsibilities, I wouldn't have the energy for it anyway. I don't want to. That's not where my life is at. That's what my 20s for. And I feel like I gave it a really good nudge, and I feel like I squeezed as much stuff out of the sponge as I possibly could have. And I feel like not knowing how things would turn out, and the great fear, which is that you will never get to do the thing that you desperately want to do, which for me was to write write for Broadway. It still is, you know, and it's not like, again, not a tick. I want to write for Broadway. I want to write, you know, things in that world. You know, if I didn't have that fear, if magically I came back and saw myself and I was like, don't worry, you're gonna get there, I probably wouldn't have got there. You know, I think the fear was a big part of it. And learning to take risks and learning to back myself and, you know, learning to develop my own voice and finding a point of difference and finding something to say and working my material in front of audiences, sometimes hostile audiences, to see, well, how does that work and how to build a song in terms of the comedy, you know, where to put the jokes so that people will understand them lyrically, you know, how to make sure that your jokes kind of increase in their humor, and, you know, and to work that in front of actual people to see how it works, and go on the road and work with musicians and be able to talk to musicians about how they play or what the idea is there, all that stuff, you know, adds up to your life in the theater, and it's learned on the job. So I feel like I'm pretty happy with that. I would probably much rather at this point my 60-year-old self, if I make it that far, to come down and come back and tell me what to do now. That would be interesting, you know. 20s, I had enough energy to cover it. Now, I don't know if I do, and it's a tricky part of life, I feel. And the pandemic has exacerbated that, but it's also like, do I just keep doing this? I just keep writing musicals because that's what I do? Or, yeah, it's possible that there could be something completely different that I do. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I don't know. So yeah, that's my very long-winded answer to that.
That was the amazing Eddie Perfect speaking to us today about what it takes for a successful career in the musical world. Follow him over on Instagram at Edmund Perfect. Follow us over on Instagram at Puzzle Piece Pod. Follow me over on Instagram at Ben_Lamb231. And check out all the other awesome Sin podcasts over at sin.org.au.